presume the hearing and Ms. Justice, how do you want to proceed?
Okay, so I haven't prepared a summary statement, but I do have some notes that I could read through that just outline my evidence.
I think we've already we've all read your evidence, so you're happy to go straight to questions, and we'll do it that way.
Sure.
I had a question rising out of 2.7. You're describing the site, at Luggett. That part of the site is you're seeking commercial overlay. No change to the zoning of the balance of the land. What is the balance actually being used for at the moment?
If you flick to figure one on my evidence, you'll see the balance is the land to the west or to the left-hand side, and it's currently zoned, well, proposed zone settlement, and it is just bush scrub zone. Not used for anything specifically at this stage.
And is that the land, when we went to site visit, our guide pointed out a water race at the top of the escarpment. Is that the land beyond the water race?
It is. It includes the water race. There is another water race right at the bottom of the site, sort of, which separates the more industrial type uses with the bush, so I'm not sure if you noticed the water race running right along the base of the hill. So it's all the land above that.
Commissioner Hill.
Just one question, again, just looking at your evidence and going to this the commercial overlay or commercial precinct, and Mr. Place's view that if that was put on, it better reflects existing activities in the boys' future non-compliances. How specific or how good a fit is it in terms of your client's existing activities?
The settlement zone with the commercial
precinct,
it's not a great fit with the existing activities.
Right.
It's more of an optimal use of the site going forward, making use of the historic
land. That was the question I read. So you disagree with Mr. Place's view?
Yeah, I would disagree with that.
Right.
Yeah.
So
I think he was also referring to the fact that it has got existing use rights.
Right.
And a resource consent drawn and part of the
activity. So I just want to make that clear. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman.
Just on your evidence in page 6 of 11, there's a map that shows the site. Have you got that in front of you?
Yes.
Figure 1. The striped hatching at the bottom of that map, what does that relate to?
That is the commercial precinct overlay that's in the proposed plan.
So that's the commercial overlay that currently exists?
Yes.
And your orange is the proposed commercial overlay that you're looking for this site?
That's right.
So it's doubling the commercial overlay of the Luggett settlement? Is that appropriate in your personal opinion?
Well, it's currently used for commercial business activities now.
Okay.
So it does reflect that existing activity.
That's my only question. Thank you.
Commissioner Monroe.
Thank you.
Commissioner Dawson.
No
questions. Thank you. Commissioner
Smith. Thank you. You know, obviously the existing use rights and existing activities on the site, are they in conflict with the proposed zoning? And how do we resolve that in moving forward?
The proposed zoning being the settlement zone with the... they are in conflict. They are a fairly heavy use of the site, and they do generate effects which are managed to a certain extent now. So going forward, they'll just carry on relying on existing use rights and the existing resource consent that's held for the site.
But if the proposed zoning enables a residential activity or a retail commercial activity, the existing activities would be in conflict with that?
Yeah, but they'd have to manage that on site if they are already existing.
Yeah, how would they go about that? Managing the amenity impacts on a residential activity versus, you know, trucking fertiliser and things like that?
I don't think there would be any residential development on the site if the Upper Clutha transport activity remains on the site.
Okay. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, next, Mr. Christensen.
Thank you. We're going to move to the to the Church Road site now, and the first witness is Mr. Cruden.
Thank you. I'm assuming everyone's read the infrastructure everyone's provided. I did not prepare it. I reviewed it prior to its submission, and I've reread through it this morning to refresh my memory, so I'm happy to take questions on the evidence.
Didn't quite catch your surname.
Cruden, C-R-U-D-E-N.
Oh, yes, of course. We've seen you before in the same role.
Oh.
On-course substitute.
Yeah.
Commissioner Hill.
Upgrade, not substitute.
What was that?
Nothing. I don't think I have a question. Just confirming that there is really nothing in contention between your evidence and the council's position.
Nothing at all.
Thank you.
Nothing from me, sir.
Commissioner Munro.
No thanks.
No, thank you.
Commissioner Smith.
Just one question. I mean, I touched on that idea that there could be 500 square metre buildings or separate activities, I suppose, within this site. You've assessed that level of vehicle movements generated by that scale of activity?
Well, wrong expert.
Sorry.
Better question might be assess that amount of wastewater.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I was aware Mr. Cruden's also a transport engineer. You've addressed the impacts of the scale of that activity on the services.
Yes, we have. In the code of practice for subdivision, you look at wastewater flow generation based on the area of industrial or commercial land. So, and it doesn't differentiate between rural and general industrial zones. So we've effectively followed the council's guidance on assessing the likely peak demands from the site based on the area, so the five hectares plus, and the council's obviously comfortable with that approach and that it follows their guidance.
That was easy.
Great.
Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. So the next witness is Mr. Carr. So mindful of my 20-page summary of last week, it's a page and a half, of which I will only perhaps talk about the very last section, because that's possibly the most material one to your consideration.
Please do.
So starting at paragraph 7, I've discussed the transportation matters relating to the submitter's site with Mr. Rossiter on the 7th of August, and Mr. Rossiter's advised that provided the extent of development within the site was no greater than 25,000 square metres GFA, then he was comfortable that the traffic generated through the rezoning could satisfactorily be accommodated on the road network in respect of roading efficiency and road safety. However, he was concerned to ensure that the means by which the scale of the permitted development was limited to 25,000 square metres was robust. I concur with Mr. Rossiter that there needs to be a robust limit to the extent of permitted development. And for clarity, my assessments to date do not address scenarios where the amount of development is greater than 25,000 square metres. Mr. Rossiter highlighted that in his view there are a number of ways in which the amount of development could be limited, but overall we both considered that this was a matter for resolution between the council and the submitter's planning experts. So on the basis of my assessment and subject to that limit of 25,000 square metres GFA of permitted development, I remain of the view there are no traffic or transportation reasons why the submission could not be approved and the site rezoned.
Mr. Carr, I had a question arising out of your paragraph 49. They saying it would be appropriate for the submitter to make a contribution towards widening Church Road, a proportionate contribution you emphasise. I understand the point you're making. What would be the mechanism to trigger that if there was no subdivision?
I would expect that, given that the present roading configuration would need to be looked at under the existing and the proposed zonings of the council, that in due course there will have to be either road maintenance or road widening that's put in place by the council. At that point, it would be a marginal cost, if any, to actually make the changes that this development would trigger. So I think that it would potentially be swept up by simply the council widening the road in the first place. I was aware that Mr. Rossiter highlighted that trigger point. I think it becomes problematic when there is no subdivision for a trigger. But in this case, we're only talking of an extra half a metre of seal, and it's not clear to me why the subdivision code requires that wider seal width in this particular instance compared to what would be provided as a matter of course through that widening that the council would undertake.
Starting on the right. Mr. Hill?
One question for me, and this is going to paragraph 27 and 28. So you said you've done your traffic assessment based on this proposal or your client's activity moving on to the site, and I understand that. could you offer us any, we were discussing with Mr. Christensen and this issue of could the site be on sale for something else, which is what you acknowledge. Can you offer us any advice if it was a different activity? I mean, I know you suggested a 25, still the 25,000, but a completely different activity which generated, say, more traffic?
So that the nature of the beast, if you like, is that without a specific activity to assess, there has to be a range of transport assessments that are made. I've put the two extremes within the within the evidence, and I've adopted a sort of a middle to high approach for doing the assessment. So it is a little bit more robust than it would be if we assumed a very large warehouse, say, with very little traffic generation. Although we didn't explicitly discuss it, Mr. Rossiter hasn't raised any concerns with that approach. So I think there's probably a degree of comfort that is robust. And the assessment that I've carried out of the intersections show that they're not running out of capacity. So even if it was to be slightly higher, I think the first thing will be unusual that all 25,000 square metres will be a very high traffic generator. You'll have some high, you'll have some low, and the average will probably work out somewhere in the middle. But even if you were to take that worst case, the intersections are not running out of capacity.
Right, thank you
very much. Thank you. Commissioner McLeod? No, the evidence is very clear. Thank you very much, Mr. Kerr.
Commissioner Monroe. Commissioner Dawson.
Just in following on from the Chair's question, because I was going to ask you about this trigger for upgrading Church Road, you're indicating if there was a subdivision, then that mechanism could, as per any normal subdivision, generate the potential for a contribution from the site to Church Road upgrading. But if there wasn't, and it was just the land uses, you're saying, did I hear you say that But the upgrading's fairly minimal anyway, and it's something that you would just rely on the council to do in good time or in due course.
Yeah, there were two elements. The first thing is that the road at the moment doesn't meet the council's own subdivision code of practice. So it's reasonable in my view to expect that the council will in due course either undertake maintenance or regrading or something of the road, and as part of that take the opportunity to bring it up to their own code. The second part is that the only difference between that and what would be required under the proposed rezoning, it's nothing to do with the movement lanes or anything else, it's to do with the shoulders. Under the zoning, it would require a 1 metre seal versus a half a metre seal on the shoulders. Now, the purpose of the seal at the shoulder is to support the road from the movement of heavy vehicles, and if half a metre is satisfactory, I'm not quite sure why you'd need 1 metre. I haven't been able to track down the rationale for widening the shoulder in that way. But the difference potentially, well, the difference would not be material if you, in my view, if you put in with a half a metre sealed shoulder instead of the 1 metre sealed shoulder. But if you're doing all those works on the road, it's a very marginal cost in terms of the difference between the two.
But you're saying that even if it stayed as it is and the council didn't get around to upgrading it till well after, if ever, the zone is developed, that heavy traffic could comfortably use the road as it is?
If the road is fit for purpose now, then it would be fit for purpose under the zoning as well.
Well, you know, that's not what I said. I said, regardless of what it's fit for, is it fit for purpose for the zoning, in your view, for the heavy traffic to be generated from
it? It is fit for purpose under the proposed zoning, but I can't speak for whether the council believes it's fit for purpose right now.
No, I'm asking your view as a traffic engineer in terms of being heavy traffic being able to use that road without the shoulders crumbling away
Well, bearing in mind that there is a industrial zoning and heavy vehicles that use that that road now, as I say, I don't have access to the council's information in respect of the road maintenance. So in terms of if the council is seeing that there is a significant issue that they need to resolve as a result of existing zonings, I wouldn't propose to say that the road is fit for purpose. But what I'm saying is that whether it's fit for purpose or not fit for purpose, its status does not change as a result of this zoning. If it needs to be upgraded, the upgrading is needed because of existing zonings not being triggered by this particular one.
Yeah, thank you. You describe level of service D as the result. I mean, that's not a pretty picture in the scheme of things. What's that look like?
I would dispute the level of service D isn't a pretty picture. It's what you'd normally expect on a road in the peak hours, CLD.
I'm aware of our transport assessments throughout the district. Can you give us an example of a level of service D in our district during peak hours?
I would say the majority of intersections within urbanised areas within the district will have a level of service D, if not E, at the peak times for priority intersections.
That's not my understanding, but I'll take your word on that.
Yeah, I mean, D is not unreasonable for an intersection in the morning peak hours. It's what you'd expect. I mean, the delays are, I think I calculated them as 30 seconds. Yeah, so it's a 30-second delay in a worst-case scenario compared to a 17-second delay that's happening at the moment. So the change in delay is 13 seconds.
And in line with the NZTA's guidelines, is that likely to... Are the additional vehicle movements generated by this likely to result in a speed limit change on that stretch of road?
So the speed limit change, if there was a speed limit change, it wouldn't be as a result of additional vehicles on the road. It would be a result of additional accesses or safety improvements. So there would be no effect on the speed limit that would be generated by additional vehicles from this proposal.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. Mr. Espy.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I've got a brief summary there that I propose to read out and then take any questions or discussion from there.
Absolutely. Please proceed.
So we've got the submission site is zoned rural zone by the PDP, Rural General and the ODP, but it's unusual in that it sits on the fringe of Luggett Town between two sites that accommodate industrial activity. Additionally, part of the site is a closed landfill. The remainder is covered in dense, mature, unkempt pines. Due to the site's characteristics and context, I consider that subject to visual effects being appropriate, the use of the site for industrial land uses will not be at odds with the patterns of existing landscape character. Existing landscape character will not be degraded. A pattern of land use commensurate with an urban fringe location and with the neighbouring sites will be enabled. The provisions that are proposed to be included in the general industrial zone or the rural industrial subzone do not provide for unrestricted development and include specific setbacks and mitigation of potential effects by way of landscaping. As will be elaborated on by Mr. Edgar, the details of final proposed provisions are subject to ongoing discussion with the Council's reporting experts. The site is plainly visible from Church Road. It currently contributes relatively little in terms of visual amenity and sits in the context that has been described, adjacent to other industrial land use on the outskirts of Luggett. By use of broad setbacks and a control of landscape treatment, I consider that a result will be enabled that is not detrimental to current visual amenity as experienced by a Church Road user. Industrial use of the site as regulated by the proposed provisions and visually screened or softened by roadside landscape treatment will not appear unexpected, incongruous or degrading in this location. The site is also visually experienced at close quarters from the public track that follows the Clutha River corridor. Again, the site currently appears as unkempt and sits between other visible industrial activities. A track user's experience is dominated by the river itself in this location. Again, I consider that the use of setbacks and landscape treatment will enable activity on the site that does not significantly degrade the amenity of a trail user compared to the current situation. As has been mentioned, discussions with council experts has been ongoing, including discussions between Mr. Jones and myself. Mr. Jones supports an instance of industrial activity in this location, but seeks some more clarity, regarding the treatment of setbacks and landscaping in relation to how the site is visually experienced from Church Road and in particular from the public track to the east of the site. I agree that these issues are important and discussions have included the concept of potential additional provisions to add clarity and certainty. So overall, due to the specific characteristics of the site and its immediate context, I consider that industrial use of the site as proposed can sit comfortably in the landscape such that character of the broader landscape is maintained.
Thank you, Mr. Espy. First of all, the track, my understanding is that that track is on Crown land and it's not a trail as defined in the PDP. Is that correct?
I understand it's on Crown land, that's right. The definition of trail, I'm not sure if that excludes that or not, but yes, yeah, so my understanding it's on Crown land.
Assuming it's therefore a public place, is the development of the site highly visible from that public place? That would the development that would be enabled by rezoning?
Well, I now understand your first question. Yes, in my understanding, whether it's a trail or not, it's on public land and that's a public place. It's on Crown land and that's a public place. Would development be highly visible from that public place? Well, it may be or it may not be, depending on exactly how it's designed and mitigated. And so, as I've said there, the discussions that I've been having with the other landscape expert, Mr. Jones, have, I suppose, focused on the issue of how mitigation would be done, and I think mitigation certainly can be done in a way that development ends up not being highly visible from that public place. And so I suppose the discussion that's then come from that is what mechanisms are needed to bring that about. And largely, I suppose, that's in the hands of the planners.
Looking at the view from Church Road, I'm interested in the policy of Chapter 6 that talks about effectively not putting things in the foreground of views of O&Ls. When we went on the site, we were trying to figure out where the BRA that you're recommending finished, and therefore once you moved up the road towards Luggett, whether it would be in the foreground of the view from the Grandview Mountains behind, or whether that is the view over the BRA, which of course we wouldn't have to worry about. Can you assist me?
I'm looking at my appendices 2 and 3 of my evidence, one of which is an aerial photograph and the other is the zone map showing the BRA. So the line of the BRA follows an existing fence line. It's also the line between the open land and the treed land, effectively. So the open land is BRA, the treed land is not.
Now, on the basis that, by definition, we couldn't see the because it's covered in trees. If those trees were not there.
Yes, well, I do talk about that in my evidence, actually. Certainly when you're passing the BRA and you're looking over this sort of rough grassland, if you look off into the distance, you can see the Grandview Mountains and their foreground. The same would most probably be true if the non-BRA part of the site was completely cleared. So I guess in the long term, I suppose, the outcome that I'm envisaging as being enabled by this zoning would replace the treed part of the site with industrial land uses, with setbacks and landscape treatment around them. And that would take the place of the trees, if you like, in those views. So as the trees now screen distant views to the grand views, the future activities would do the same. Perhaps less so, I suppose, depending on height and things.
It's unlikely that your mitigation would be quite as high as those pine trees.
Yes.
questions, I think, and looking at Mr. Jones' rebuttal evidence, and I know you're in discussion with him. Firstly, this is at 6.9. It was just, he just was seeking that clarification, the 20-metre setback from the O&L boundary. Has that been resolved, or was that clear? Partly goes to...
The cadastral boundary of the site is obviously clearly identified. The O&L line that's shown in the PDP is very close to being on that cadastral boundary, but is very slightly off.
Right.
It appears to me they're supposed to be in the same place, which would make sense. I suppose there's a difference of probably what is a metre or two. I think really the resolution there is to make them the same line, and it makes sense.
So we're at the margins on that. The other question, which is partly a planning question, and again it goes to 6.10 of his rebuttal, which you might have in front of you, but basically where Mr. Jones is saying that the rural industry subzone, in his view, is a better one because council has better control over design of buildings. Have you had a look at that issue, and do you agree with it?
I've had a brief look at that, yes, when I was considering the effects, and I suppose we're talking about some bespoke provisions going in to do with setbacks and things. So to my mind, it probably doesn't make a great deal of difference between the rural industrial subzone and the general industrial zone. Although, my reading of the general industrial zone is that it is actually more restrictive of activities that might affect landscape than the rural industrial subzone. So certainly when I was doing my evidence the first time round to do with the submission as it was lodged, I was thinking mostly about that general industrial zone in which any building is restricted discretionary, as I understand it. So, it's probably better for the planners, but to my mind, the general industrial zone is actually a bit better.
Better than that. Okay, thank you very much.
Commissioner McLeod.
Yep. Afternoon, Mr. Espy. Or morning, I should say.
Morning.
Just a couple of small questions. Do you consider the views from State Highway 8 from the cutting, looking over the site? Was it something that you considered in your assessment?
Yes, I did, and it's the cutting and then the start of the Luggett Terrace Road. In practical terms, it's very difficult to get a view of the site in which you would recognise any activity. Again, even in these longer views, I guess it's less of an issue in these longer views, but again, I think the mitigation type treatment that's eventually done would be important, planting around the periphery of the site and that sort of thing.
And that is even touching on the degree of scale. And I must admit, when you see 25,000 square metres, to my mind, it doesn't imply. So I had to go on looking for examples, and Commissioner Smith has alluded to this. 25 square metres is about 2.5 times the size of Hangar 4, for example, which is the largest aircraft hangar that Air New Zealand have got. And suddenly that's... So even you're confident from a landscape perspective that if you had several small buildings, that might be effective, but from a structure of that scale, it could be mitigated.
Well, overall, I came to the opinion that, yes, it could. I mean, I looked at that provision. As I say, in my understanding, any building's restricted discretionary, and then you've got this upper limit of 25,000 square metres beyond which I guess you're non-complying or something. In looking at this zone since we started work on it, with the submitter, there's been various... I guess what you'd call draft layouts that have been configured to do with how an activity would actually sit on that site. I suppose, of course, the submitter was thinking about his own activity, but I imagine it would apply to other industrial activities quite similarly. These industrial activities invariably involve parking and yard space and vehicle manoeuvring, often for trucks and things like this. So the practicalities of siting an operation on this site, I think will necessarily break up buildings with yard space and internal access and what have you, and also will mean that you don't get near 25,000 square metres. So I guess I had those things in my mind when I was making my assessment.
Just with regard to the trail, because at that particular point, having ridden the trail a few times, it rises up from both directions, whether you're coming from the Red Bridge or from further up. And I get your point about the Clutha River as the dominant feature, no matter how, but you are actually rising up and onto and I'd be interested in your advice as to if there was mitigation that was to be put within the 20 metre setback on that edge, what that would entail to be effective, because your eye is drawn higher.
Yeah, well, just looking at my, I'm looking at my Appendix 2 again, and on that you can see the cadastral boundaries of the site, and you can see that piece of crown land, and on the aerial photo you can actually see the trail alignment there. You can see the trail running along, and you're right, as you get towards that sort of central part of the site, elevation rises up, so you're kind of level with the site at that point. As you can see on that aerial photo, the trail itself is probably close to 20 metres away from the cadastral boundary anyway, and then inside that cadastral boundary you're going to have a 20 metre setback. I think that gives plenty of room for a good mitigation treatment along that edge. There are various spots around the district, of course, where trails, I mean, trails largely, very largely go through countryside sort of landscape, and that's the type of amenity that a trail user gets, but there are various spots where the trails come close to a settlement or right beside a settlement, including industrial type activities at places like Glenda Drive. Trails become right close to it, and so a trail user has these instances of coming close to some activity and then moving off into the countryside again, and I think provided that edge is treated well, that doesn't degrade the whole trail experience. It's something you pass by and keep going. So I certainly think a mitigation treatment along that edge in this location could be a really complete screen almost. It could be a high area of mixed native shrubs and trees and what have you, such that a trail user really doesn't look into the site at all. I don't think you're losing anything by not looking into the site. Attention is directed towards the river corridor.
And my final question is to do with the Luggett settlement doesn't have a build like a urban growth boundary, but that's been requested by the Luggett community through the their visioning plan, and it's something that potentially will be addressed by council in the life of this plan. From your perspective, would this fit within or external to an urban growth boundary? How would you see it fitting within that? And that's within the context of a JIS versus a RIS, if you get what I mean.
Yes. Well, you know, it sounds a bit academic to me, but what actually sits on the land there, I think, will be appropriate. I suppose it would make sense to me to include it within an urban growth boundary if you're going to draw an urban growth boundary. I suppose the urban growth boundary would have to be drawn carefully to include this site and the sawmill site, and then down to the rural living area of Luggett. I think it's a rural residential zone. Yes, I think generally rural living zones aren't included inside an urban growth boundary, so I'm not quite sure how that would work, but yeah, it seems a bit of an academic argument to me. I guess the activities that sit on the ground are what I've assessed, and I've called this a sort of a urban fringe location or a township edge location, whether it's just inside the edge or just outside the edge, I don't know.
That's all from me, sir. Thank you.
Commissioner Munro.
Yes. Yeah, just a follow-up to the response you gave Commissioner McLeod when he posed to you the question of larger scale buildings reminiscent of hangars up to about 25,000 square metres GFA. And what I heard you respond with was effectively you didn't see 25,000 squares of GFA being really achievable anyway. Did I hear that right?
Well, yes, that's probably my understanding. I guess that's not a hard and fast answer. I suppose if the question is it actually achievable, my answer, I suppose, is I don't know. But the draft layouts and things that I've looked at makes it appear quite unlikely, okay. I'd say.
Well, that sort of brings me to a fork in the road and puts two propositions to you. One is either the prospect put to you by Commissioner McLeod is achievable, and you might want to revise the answer you gave, or it's not achievable, in which case my question is, what scale of GFA do you think is achievable?
In practical terms, on the ground there. Well, I'm afraid, again, probably my answer is I don't know without looking at it more closely. From memory, the sort of draft layouts that I'm thinking about, a number of buildings separated by yards and what have you, and I imagine the total footprint of all the buildings together might be, might be 10,000, I suppose. These were sort of large hangar-type buildings or storage-type buildings. But I suppose that is dependent upon exactly what industrial activity locates here. It could be more than that.
Appreciate you're on the spot trying to recall a whole number of details from various plans, so I'll try and put this to you like this. Can you envisage a scale or type of development on the site that would, in your mind, start creating problematic effects from a landscape perspective?
Hypothetically, yes, and I guess that's mostly to do with building height and encroachment on setbacks rather than its overall footprint.
Okay, all right. Thanks for that.
Question, Dawson?
Yes. You said you've been talking to Mr. Jones, and and the planners have been talking together, we understand, about the provisions that might go into whether it's the GIZ or the rural industrial subzone. Have you, in terms of you and Mr. Jones, he's raised issues regarding the nature and of the landscape treatment along the boundaries, avoiding things like outdoor storage and vehicle parking in those areas, the use of the existing pine trees or the replacement for them. And then you talked to the chairman about height and type of screening that might screen the Grandview Mountains. Have you been talking about those sorts of things with Mr. Jones at that level of detail?
Yes. Yep.
And have you and Mr. Jones reached agreement in terms of the outcomes that you as landscape architects would like to see achieved, albeit that
I'd say yes, we have. Yeah. In meticulously defined way, but in a broad way, yes.
Yes. So, are you hopeful that what? And you haven't seen what the planners have been drafting. Did I hear that?
Well, we had a meeting even up to yesterday, and so I'm not sure that they've been drafting a set of provisions that they both agree on. I don't think they have got to that stage yet, but it looks like maybe that's the next stage.
But from the point of view of the discussions between you and Mr. Jones, you would be hopeful that the provisions that reflect your landscape concerns could be, an agreement could be reached on those.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And my only other question is about the big BRA up at the north end of the site, which is the closed landfill, as I understand it. Should this be in the zone? When you've been looking at the zone, what have you anticipated happening on that area of the site in terms of landscape effects? Or have you just anticipated nothing?
No. I've anticipated, in discussions with the submitter and with the experts, I've anticipated some sort of yard-like activity there, perhaps intermittent vehicle parking and storage and that sort of thing, but not buildings.
Yeah, just not buildings.
That's right.
And so your recommendations regarding landscape treatment on both sides of the Church Road and the riverside of the site include going right through that area,
yes,
because
right.
there would be some activity on there, yes. of an industrial nature, albeit not buildings.
Yes.
Oh, thank you for that. That's all. Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Thank you. I suppose I'm particularly interested in scale, and you know we've touched on this a few times, that 25,000 square metres by any measure is an enormous building footprint. And I've just done a bit of a exercise by, you're familiar with Enterprise Drive off Ballantyne Road? Okay, I just did a bit of a count up, and there's somewhere in the order of 40 sections in there, some, you know, range of activities that, some vacant at the moment, but, you know, potentially there'll be a range of activities in there. The scale of the buildings certainly could be similar to, you know, what the provisions might enable in this situation. So what we're looking at, and we talked about Mitre 10 mega, that you, in building footprint, you could effectively have three Mitre 10 megas. You could have the equivalent of Enterprise Drive in terms of scale and the number of buildings, the size of buildings enabled on this site. Do you think that is consistent with your comments that, where was it, that this wouldn't be unexpected or is consistent with the rural landscape in this location?
Well, I guess I was always envisaging an outcome that has to go through a resource consent process of at least restricted discretionary and an outcome that necessarily is going to involve car parking and perhaps truck parking and manoeuvring and yard spaces and so on. So
I suppose you've already acknowledged that the building restriction area could equally be used for the car parking and the truck manoeuvring and things like that. So we're still dealing, there's still, you know, significant opportunity for those things to occur. And looking at the restricted discretionary rules, I don't see anything in there that would enable us to control the scale or the extent of the activity in that. It talks about external appearance of buildings, landscaping from a directly amenity point of view, but I don't see anything about scale. I don't see anything about rural amenity or outlook, cumulative effects, anything that would give us control over the scale, over the ultimate scale of the activity.
Yeah, I guess through a restricted discretionary rule, you couldn't turn down footprint per se unless it was over that 25,000 square metres. I suppose that's right, but there would be control over landscaping, external appearance and what have you,
but that doesn't limit the scale of the activity anyway.
Yeah, that's right. I suppose that wouldn't enable you to turn down footprint area and say your footprint's too much even though it's under 25,000 square metres. I suppose that's correct. I suppose in my assessment of landscape effects of the zone, I come back to what I was saying, that really the, without knowing a specific operation sitting in there, which as I say is necessarily going to involve a number of things other than buildings, so I'd be very surprised if somebody can get close to 25,000, but I guess envisaging effects, I have primarily arrived at my opinions by thinking about height and setbacks, since those are the things that really dictate how people will experience it from outside the site. You know, in some ways, to oversimplify it, you could say, provided the height's right and the setbacks are the right size and the setbacks are all treated correctly, then people won't understand what's inside the site. They won't know whether it's 25,000 or 20,000. So, that's putting it, as I say, that's oversimplifying it, but that's the crux of my assessment of potential landscape effects, is if we get the things right to do with height and setbacks and the treatment of those setbacks, then footprint is not so much a determinant for me.
So you've relied on the existing activities to justify this to a degree, so that the you've talked about it being adjoining to or compatible with the existing activities, but I mean, what's your view on the comparative scale of the two and how they'll be viewed in the landscape? You know, like if you compare the existing activity next door, we can pluck a figure out of the air in terms of what the footprint is, but it's pretty clear that it's not anywhere near the same footprint scale.
Yeah, well, it's a smaller site, obviously. I mean, it's and so is the area to the north that's used for industrial. They're all smaller. But again, as you say, how will it be viewed? Well, I think it'll be viewed by observers who are enjoying visual amenity without reference in their mind to a footprint. They'll be more influenced by what the external appearance of the site is, how they experience it while they go past it, rather than the footprint equation of what's inside the site.
And so if we're to go to the rural industrial subzone concept, I suppose, and if I draw your attention to the policies surrounding that, and it talks about providing for established nodes of industrial activity while protecting, maintaining and enhancing the landscape. Now, how big, in the visual sense, how big is a node versus an area or a zone or a developed, how do you define what a node looks like in that context?
Well, I guess that's, in my understanding, that's talking about existing nodes and providing for existing nodes. So, so I suppose in the instance of the actual zone to the immediate south of the site here, there's the existing velvet and venison operation and sawmill and what have you. So they're an existing node. So I guess they're defined by what they currently are. In that case, the existing node doesn't spread onto our site, I suppose.
Okay, so if we're reliant on... Okay, except that point that this isn't... You're not trying to expand the node, so it doesn't seem to be consistent with the rural industrial activity policies. Would that be correct?
Well, if they say provide for existing nodes, then yes.
Okay. So if we're then looking towards a general industrial zone approach, are you then having to apply the urban, in terms of the strategic level, and looking at the landscape issues, are we then looking at an urban environment in a rural landscape?
Well, yeah, in my understanding, I understand what you're alluding to, whereby at a strategic level, the plan is saying industrial zones should be inside urban areas.
Well, what I'm saying is that if you are to accept that it doesn't meet the guidelines for rural industrial activities around policy, then you have to view it from, imposing an urban environment into a rural landscape from a strategic level, and have to deal with it with all the higher order policies that relate to that, including how you deal with urban growth boundaries, consolidating urban environments.
I wonder, Commissioner, if that's a discussion you should have with Mr. Edgar.
Yeah, and no doubt will, but I suppose, certainly from Mr. Espy's perspective, the higher order policies really in that context relate to landscape in to a large degree, so I'm still interested in that view.
Yeah, well, I guess the strategic objectives and policies to do with landscape do set out in a broad sense over the district how landscape should be dealt with, and they make a distinction between urban and rural, and I think that's fair enough. I suppose the way I've talked about this location, not just our site but the neighbouring sites, is as a a town outskirts sort of a location. It's almost neither urban nor rural. So I think maybe that's the problem we're facing. It doesn't quite fit into either. I suppose the strategic objectives and policies don't really take account of instances like that where it's not quite one or the other. It's a transitional town outskirts location.
We're getting down a rabbit hole, but doesn't the policy discourage that though, to define urban edges and sort of avoiding sprawl and using landscape natural boundaries and things like that? Wouldn't that be discouraged by the policy?
Well, in general terms, it probably would if you just read that policy. But I guess the overriding factor that weighs in favour of this proposed rezoning is its context, I think. And the context is there. There are these activities on the ground that this is going to be right beside. So if that doesn't quite fit with those strategic and policies objectives, I'm not sure.
Okay. So one final question is, would your assessment be the same if those adjoining activities didn't exist on Church Road, if that was an undeveloped environment?
No, it probably wouldn't be the same, no.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Espy. Once again.
Yeah, so I see what you mean. So that the matters of discretion under the subzone restricted discretionary include a few things that are not included under the matters of discretion.
Yes, but only for an individual
building. Well, no, I hadn't actually noticed that. I hadn't noticed that. I guess between myself and Mr. Jones, we've maybe stayed out of that argument a little bit and left that more to the planners. Given that there's going to be some bespoke rules, if those bespoke rules can be slotted into the subzone or the other zone, I guess we haven't delved into exactly which one would be better in that regard.
Yes, so the bespokeness of it
will deal with it.
Well, now.
Thank you.
We bid you farewell, Mr. Espy.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Edgar to finish, sir.
While Mr. Edgar is setting up, is it your intent that when these provisions that are being discussed are arrived at, you would give them to us with some supporting evidence, or how are you proposing to actually present that to us?
That's a good question.
I'm proposing that the submitter won't be presenting any additional evidence. It'll be in the council reply.
I suppose what's exercising my mind is that the hope is that what gets presented by the officers in their reply is an agreed set of provisions and everything's done and dusted. But that's yet to be determined whether that's the position that's reached. And what's exercising my mind, Commissioner Munro, is whether or not Mr. Edgar, his position now or following the next discussion with Mr. Place may be different from what's in his evidence at the moment. And it may be helpful to find a way to get that in front of the panel before the hearing closes.
Well, let's leave it because we're dealing with hypotheticals. If you need to apply for leave, then we'll deal with that at the top.
Okay.
Mr. Edgar.
Thank you. The submission of Precluitha Transport seeks the partial rezoning of a site at Church Road, Luggett, from rural to general industrial. The relief sought would see approximately 8 hectares of the 14-hectare site rezoned general industrial, with a building restriction area covering the northern portion of the site and 20-metre setbacks along Church Road and the Clutha River boundaries. The remaining land within the proposed general industrial zone would that could accommodate built development, being outside of the building restriction area and setbacks, measures approximately 5 hectares. The relief sought also includes amendments to the general industrial rules to provide for workers' accommodation on the submission site and to limit built development to 25,000 square metres in order that traffic effects can be appropriately managed. There is some disagreement between Mr. Place and I regarding the appropriateness of the GIZ, the proposed staff accommodation and the 25,000 GFA limit. However, while Mr. Place does not support the proposed GIZ, he does, as I understand it, support in principle the application of the rural industrial subzone to the site as an alternative zoning subject to appropriate management of landscape and traffic effects. I've been in discussions with Mr. Place regarding the amended provisions set out in my evidence in chief. In addition, as directed by the panel, Mr. Place and Mr. Jones have revisited the site to consider visibility from the public walking and cycling track to the east. Following on from that site visit, Mr. Espy and I have been in further discussions with Mr. Place and Mr. Jones. The matters discussed include the following. Landscape treatment along the northern, western and eastern boundaries of the site and how or when the implementation of that landscape treatment will be triggered. An example of a possible solution being whether the approval and implementation of a landscape management plan prior to the construction of buildings would be suitable. Whether the setbacks from Church Road and the Clutha River would be more appropriate as building restriction areas. Whether an increased setback building restriction area is required along the Clutha River boundary of the site. Whether the BRA or the landfill area is necessary. And whether this would or should restrict the parking of vehicles in this area. Whether a structure plan would be an appropriate means of managing the use and development of the site and associated landscape treatment, and how that would fit into the PDP. Given the limited time available between Mr. Place and Mr. Jones's site visit and this hearing, we have not yet been able to resolve these matters and prepare an amended set of provisions. However, there appears to be general agreement that with further work, provisions could be arrived at that would allow for the development and use of the site for industrial purposes while appropriately managing landscape effects. In this regard, I consider that the preparation of a relatively simple structure plan would be an appropriate means of addressing landscape matters and providing greater certainty and clarity as to how the zone is to be used and developed. Such a structure plan could include the currently proposed setbacks as building restriction areas, including the provision of a setback building restriction area along the northern boundary of the site, and if required, an increased setback building restriction area along the eastern boundary. and the use of activity areas to direct the use and development of the site. An example being an activity area covering the northern portion of the site that limits the use to vehicle parking, and an activity area covering the remainder of the zone and providing for built development. I consider that such a structure plan, along with corresponding rules or rule amendments, would assist in providing greater certainty that the landscape effects of development within the zone will be appropriately managed, and would assist in the drafting of rules relating specifically to the submission site, in that the structure plan rather than legal descriptions could be referenced. Regarding the proposed use of the zone, a point I wish to clarify relates to the intended use of the northern portion of the site that is covered by the currently proposed building restriction area. It is envisaged by the submitter that the landfill area in this part of the site would be capped and would provide for truck parking. This is an important element of Upper Clutha Transport's operations, as adequate flat ground is required to manoeuvre and park their fleet of up to 30 truck and trailer units, each unit being 23 metres long, 2.5 metres wide and 4.3 metres high. I consider that the use of the site in this manner could be provided for through the structure plan, and that amended provisions relating to the extent and timing of landscape treatment within the setback BRAs can ensure that landscape effects of this use can be appropriately managed. With regard to the provision of workers' accommodation, I consider that the matters of discretion set out in my proposed rule provide council with the ability to assess and control workers' accommodation to ensure it has a genuine link to the activities being undertaken in the zone. If a limit on the extent of workers' accommodation is deemed necessary, the submitter is advised that accommodation for 8 to 10 staff would meet their needs. However, I consider that the inclusion of such a limit may unnecessarily complicate the provisions. The proposed 25,000 square metre building coverage limit is intended to set a land use trigger beyond which effects on the wider roading network resulting from development within the zone are assessed and managed. I consider this limit appropriate and not dissimilar to building coverage limits used elsewhere in the PDP, albeit that it is expressed in square metres rather than a percentage. I do not consider that the proposed limit is unreasonably restrictive or that it has the potential to compromise the viability or appropriateness of the zone. Overall, I consider that subject to some further refinement of the provisions, the general industrial zone is an appropriate zone for the site. That being said, I consider that similar outcomes could be achieved through the application of the rural industrial subzone as suggested by Mr. Place.
Thank you, Mr. Edgar. Mr. Hill, would you like to start?
Thank you. Can I start sort of at the broader level? The questions were put to Mr. Christensen. So, I mean, your professional opinion is that the GIZ zone is the most appropriate. That's what I'm interpreting your last paragraph. Is it an urban zone?
Yes, in that it would accommodate urban development.
Does it necessarily follow then, just going back to the strategic provisions, I know not entirely settled, but the clear direction is that urban growth boundaries are to be used to sort of identify and work out where urban industrial urban activities and therefore by implication the GIZ would go.
Mm.
That by implication would need an urban growth boundary. This doesn't have one, and therefore is it a good strategic fit at that higher level?
Yeah, I don't believe that it does require an urban growth boundary. The strategic objectives and policies when discussing urban growth boundaries, they seek to locate them around the major settlements, and then limiting urban development to within the urban growth boundary, but around or in relation to other rural settlements. Urban development is to be located within or adjacent to those settlements.
So, again, the broader planning question, doesn't that lead to potentially a whole series of spot zones dotted all over the place where you can identify that the effects may be acceptable, and therefore undermines that broader strategic view of consolidation, compact, and does, and I go to your supplementary statement of the National Policy Statement on Urban Development, does that start to unbundle that form of sort of policy direction?
No, because I think if the general industrial zone was to be an appropriate zone, it would still need to be linked to an existing settlement.
So how does that apply here? Are you saying because it's associated with Luggett, but not contiguous to?
No, it doesn't immediately abut the settlement zone. It's been described as being on the fringe or a peri-urban location associated with Luggett. I think a location has been sought outside of the existing settlement to avoid future reverse sensitivity effects that upper inclusive transport are currently experiencing within the settlement. So in my view, while it doesn't immediately abut the settlement zone, I think it's part of the wider, or it could be part of the wider settlement.
Could be.
Yes.
I have one more question, then Mr. Chair, it might be useful, there might be some questions on this at that same strategic level, it might be better to be all asked at once, but coming then to the whether the GIZ zone is more appropriate than the sub-zone, you're asking for some quite bespoke provisions in terms of scale, in terms of workers' accommodation. Is there a planning mechanism, it's partly a legal question, but is there a planning mechanism? You know, the tenor of the questions we've been asking, this zone has been asked for by Upper Clutha for and argued for their activity, but there's nothing necessary to say that it must be or can be. Can you imagine or offer any opinion on whether it should be or could be linked to a specific proposal?
I'm not aware of a mechanism that would link it to a specific proposal, and I'm not sure that it should be. I mean, the intended outcome of the submitter is to relocate, but the zone, I think, needs to be fit for purpose, regardless of who ultimately occupies it.
So, and again, as I talk to Mr. Christian, I can see why, from your client's perspective, this would be a good outcome from both ends. But for example, if the zone were confirmed with bespoke provisions like workers' accommodation, which wouldn't apply necessarily to other GIZ zones, is that appropriate? Because what you're asking for is specific to this site, but clearly others will say, well, it's being applied for or put here. Why wouldn't you have it somewhere else? And your argument might be because this is an activity that Upper Clutha Transport needs because it needs to have overnight accommodation for its drivers and those sorts of things. But how does that reconcile with your view that the GIZ zone is appropriate as opposed to something more targeted like the sub-zone?
I can see that there's perhaps difficulty in that in the future people might, landowners may seek to have workers' accommodation within the general industrial zone. In the proposed provisions, it is tied to this site. If somebody was to seek that in the future, I think it would have to be considered on its merits. And the it would have to have a genuine link to the functional requirements of the industrial activities. In terms of whether the rural industrial subzone is more targeted, I don't, or more suited to the activities, I don't know that it necessarily is. I mean, the majority of the activities can be accommodated or could be accommodated within the rural industrial subzone, but I think the general industrial zone provides greater certainty going forward.
I was listening to your answer, Mr. Ecker, and wondering whether the case for workers' accommodation in this particular situation is about truck drivers who arrive from a long distance, unload, and are out of hours, effectively.
Yeah.
You've drafted a generalised test connected to functional needs. If it were more targeted towards road transport, which is not the same thing as your client's activities, but if it was more targeted towards road transport workers needing to stop moving effectively, would that be a solution that might solve both problems?
Yes, I think so. I think we'd need to be careful that the workers' accommodation remains practical. In that, if a driver works Monday to Friday, and lives, you know, elsewhere outside of the district, would they need to vacate the workers' accommodation on the weekend? I think it is, in this instance, it is the key function of it is to provide those rest facilities. But I think at the same time we need to be practical in terms of what it actually provides for.
Commissioner McLeod.
Good morning, Mr. Regular. The interesting one of the questions I had was related to the 20-metre setback and in your experience, which has now become with a 10-metre height, is that enough? And you've mentioned an increased setback on the BRA along the eastern boundary. What sort of increase are we talking about?
We didn't come to an agreed figure, and I think it would depend on the timing of the implementation of the landscaping, and the type and nature of the landscaping. If we can ensure that there is a consent trigger that requires suitable landscaping within the building restriction areas, then my understanding of the discussion was that if we can sort out the landscaping, then we can then look at the required, whether there's any requirement to increase the setback or the building restriction area.
And again, looking at taking the fit for purpose of this site for Upper Clutha's needs and setting it to one side, and looking at the future use of it, an alternative use of the site, would the scale of what's being proposed here, would that have an influence in a planning perspective? I mean, you'd have to accept that you could have 25,000 square metres of built form. And is that appropriate for this site, given application?
Yes, I believe, provided the landscape effects can be mitigated through the landscaping within the setbacks or the building restriction areas, I think it's appropriate. And in terms of whether it's practical or achievable, I think the in terms of achieving that sort of floor area, I think the area of the zone that is not covered by the setbacks or the current building restriction area is around 5 hectares. So 25,000 square metres would be 50% building coverage. So I think if 75% is achievable in the general industrial zone, then 50% coverage on a specific area within the proposed zone would be equally achievable. But again, that it would depend on the occupier of the site and how they wanted to use how they wanted to use the zone.
Thank you. Just touching on the workers' accommodation, there's no suggested control of scale, or is there a suggested control of scale relating to that 25,000 square metres that I can see in a few?
Not in my evidence in chief. There is a matter of discretion that allows council to consider whether there's a functional need for it. As I outlined in my summary, I think the submitter has indicated that up to 10 staff members would serve their needs.
I absolutely take that point.
But
I did say if we set that aside and looked at the zone moving forward, so are we suggesting 25,000 square metres of visitors of workers accommodation?
No. I wouldn't have thought so, because there would still have to be some industrial activities happening on the site to justify the visitor workers accommodation.
Well, let's say that I take that point. One remaining, and you addressed the urban growth boundary, thank you very much for that, is the Luggett community plan and community plans in general. How much weight should I be applying? I get the fact that it needs to be considered. I get the fact that they eventually work their way into planning documents. But could you give me some understanding of, because it's obviously fairly clearly identified as a potential industrial zoning.
Yeah.
So how much weight should I be looking to apply in my thinking?
I don't think you can give it a significant amount of weight. It's a non-statutory document, but I think it is reflective of the community's aspirations for the settlement and the land around the settlement.
So not significant weight?
Don't think so.
And that's all from me, thank you.
Mr. Munro. Mr. Dawson.
Just a few questions. You say that you and Mr. similar to the questions I asked Mr. Espy, you say that you and Mr. Place have reached agreement generally, but there are three things that you list here that you haven't agreed on. The appropriateness of the GIZ versus the subzone, the proposed staff accommodation, and the 25,000 square metre GVA limit. So does that mean that in terms of the suite of rules that will be required in relation to the building setbacks, the planting, what activities can go in the building setbacks, what activities can go in the northern BRA area, you've generally reached agreement on all those matters, sort of the more sort of tangible matters?
I think I wouldn't go as far as to say we've reached agreement, but the general feeling from the discussion is that we will be able to reach an agreement on those matters. It will just be a case of fine-tuning what's proposed, and I think in that regard we're on a similar page.
Yeah, so things like, I think you mentioned, you know, how, if there wasn't subdivision, how you would implement landscaping prior to vehicle parking on the northern area, for example. It's a matter of really working through the detail and whether you use a structure plan or not, for example, rather than disagreeing in principle. But in principle, you've still got the disagreements regarding those three matters you've put in paragraph three of your summary.
As I understand it, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
Sorry, that is based on discussions with Mr. Place, rather than the discussion between myself and Mr. Place and Mr. Espy and Mr. Jones.
Yeah, because they're more fundamental planning disagreements. Okay. So just if you could help me, please, because I still struggle to get my head around all these strategic direction chapters. And you helpfully refer to the different strategic policies in chapter 3 and 4 as it relates to whether or not the use of a urban growth boundary and whether or not you need that in a settlement, in one of the rural settlements that's covered by a settlement zone. And I think I've been given, and I keep using this section of chapter 3 that's come out of the consent orders. And it says on policies 3, 3, 13, 14 and 15, which are three that you refer to here, it just has the word topic 3 beside them on this version here. Have they found their way through another consent order, or are they still subject to outstanding appeal matters?
I believe there are draft consent orders. I think they were attached to Mr. Place's rebuttal evidence that includes some tweaks to the wording of the policies relating to urban development.
Yes, because they go over into chapter 4 in a way, and that and it, I'm interested in seeing the final version of those chapter 3 policies relating to urban development and how they relate to the chapter 4 policies to urban development, because I've also been given a draft consent order on topic 3, urban development, which only includes, well, in this regard, the chapter 4 policies, objectives and policies. So I'm just wondering where these urban development policies in chapter 3, where they are in terms of the appeal process.
I don't know, I'm afraid.
Okay, so you don't know whether they're going to be deleted and replaced by chapter 4, for example?
No, I don't know.
All right, so we'll need these, because I have got this draft consent order from Mr. Place's evidence, and it doesn't cover those policies.
Right. Okay.
All right. So you've been relying, in policies 3, 3, 13 to 15, you've been relying on the decisions, the consolidated decisions version of those.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, well, I mean, they'll probably end up somewhere or some version of them, and there is quite a lot of similarity between chapter 3 and chapter 4 as they're evolving. So is it your... Am I reading it right that... you were asked, you know, whether this could end up in a proliferation of GIS zones, say, scattered throughout the rural area.
Yeah.
But is it your position that, no, that couldn't happen because these policies say they have to be either in or adjoining or adjacent to a settlement?
Yes, yeah.
And does that come out of the Chapter 4 policies as well as those Chapter 3 ones that... have vanished?
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So in your view, although there's not an urban growth boundary, there's enough in there to say they have to be attached to or adjacent to or within a settlement and can't just float off more broadly. And, and that this site is sufficiently close to Luggett to be part of or immediately adjacent to Luggett.
Yeah, in my view it is, yeah.
All right. So my other questions about this workers' accommodation. I mean, workers' accommodation isn't defined, and you haven't proposed a definition of it.
No.
So, because we've had, you know, people, all sorts of people are asking for workers' accommodation all over the place, and sometimes that basically means the permanent residence of a worker who's working on that, or on or from that site. Are you intending it to mean that? Because you've already said they might stay for the weekend. And what will their partners come to, or their children, for those weekends? I mean, what are you really intending? Or are you proposing on behalf of your client?
Yeah, the primary focus of it, if, you know, assuming the land was to be rezoned and upper inclusive transport or to relocate, would be to provide those rest overnight rest facilities for workers, but I think that could include some more permanent residential or workers' accommodation. You know, I think it would be unreasonable to require an employee to vacate the workers' accommodation on the weekend, for example, if they're staying there through the week. And, you know, thinking about the purpose of the workers' accommodation, providing rest facilities, I think that has that would complicate matters further, in that if you finish work on a Friday, is it appropriate to then drive 2 or 3 hours home, or do you stay till Monday, Saturday morning, and then leave, and then
so,
do you come
back
on this?
It's becoming very close to, well, people whose work is ancillary to the site can live there. And is that really what you're intending? That a certain number of people will, for all intents and purposes, live on site if their work is ancillary to the industrial uses on the site. And they might have a role that's functionally connected to that site.
Yeah, potentially, if, you know, if there is a desire for people to live on the site.
Isn't that pretty much just residential activity in a GIS zone where it's not normally allowed for?
No, I don't think so, because it still would have to come back to being associated with the industrial activities. It's not unrestricted residential activity.
But it's residential activity ancillary to the industrial activities, the way you've written it. Which is pretty broad, fairly broad. Yeah, so you're certainly not looking at to just be people, you know, having a bed that they lie down on to get their required number of hours of sleep up before they start their next shift on the road. You're looking at it being more than that.
Yeah, further potential to be more than that, but at the same time, not seeking to provide on-site accommodation that isn't tied to the industrial activities.
I mean, how's that different to visitor accommodation and having people that work on in visitor accommodation being having their residential accommodation? I mean, any use could seek to have residential accommodation tied to that use.
Mm.
Is that what you're intending?
Yeah, ultimately I think it's... There's a functional need to provide some accommodation to meet the needs of what is envisaged as the use of the site. But I think some flexibility is reasonable to allow for that accommodation to be used when those people aren't strictly working.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. I am conscious there's a few commissioners, so I'll try and keep it brief. Firstly, just touch on structure plans. You sort of indicated you like the idea of a structure plan. I'm sure you've come across that they've become quite challenging, I suppose, from an administration point of view in this district. Do you think that's a useful tool in this case, or do you think it sort of just goes down that same route?
Yeah, I think it would be useful. Yep.
Okay. You, in your brief, you said that you've sort of broken it down to say that 5 hectares of the site are developable as such if you take away the setbacks and the... So, if I'm correct, 5 hectares is 50,000 square metres.
Mm.
And so 25,000 square metres would be 50% site coverage of the developable area, not the setbacks, and that we'd still have the BRA and the setbacks that could equally be used for parking and manoeuvring areas for vehicles. I'm just sort of... The suggestion that was unlikely to occur, do you think 50% site coverage of buildings is actually practical or not?
Feasible? Generally, I think it is. Within that part of the site, you know, setting aside what the submitter intends for the site.
On that, I suppose that I don't think we can separate what's intended versus what is enabled. And you know, so what I'm trying to establish is 25,000 square metres practically enabled by the proposal? And is that's what we're looking at, not something else.
Yes, it's enabled.
Okay. You also imply that the 25,000 metres is a threshold, not a limit.
Mm.
You sort of say beyond that we might revisit it and come back and ask for more, effectively. Is that your position, that there could actually be more than 25,000 metres of built footprint on this site?
Yeah, the limits... That limit triggers a restricted discretionary activity consent, and the matters of discretion are limited to traffic effects. So yeah, potentially, if an operator occupied the site that needed more than 25,000 square metres, then they could seek consent.
And is it, keeping in mind those examples we used before, that you know, would effectively enable 3 Mitre 10 Megas or 5 Wanaka New Worlds or, you know, an entire transplant of the Enterprise Drive industrial area onto the site in terms of built form and activity? Is it your view that that scale of activity is appropriate or not?
Provided the landscape effects can be and the traffic effects can be appropriately mitigated, yeah.
So we touched on, I suppose, that at both ends there's a bit of a conflict in the rural industrial zone. There's a bit of a conflict in that it's not an existing node, that it's potentially of a scale that's not no longer industrial, rural industrial. And if we're to go to the other extreme and go to a general industrial zone, that we're potentially accepting that it's an urban, it is an urban environment. I just want to draw your attention to the policies in Chapter 4. So, I'll just read these briefly. 4.2.1.2, focus urban development on land within and selected locations adjacent to existing larger urban settlements, and to a lesser extent accommodate urban development within smaller rural settlements. Ensure that urban development is contained within the defined urban growth boundaries, and that aside from urban development within existing rural settlements, urban development is avoided outside of those boundaries. Avoid sprawling or sporadic urban development across rural areas in the Upper Clutha. Rural land outside of urban growth boundaries is not used for urban development until further investigations indicate that more land is needed to meet demand for urban development. Goes on to growth boundaries. And then contain urban development of existing rural settlements that have no defined urban growth boundary within land zone for that purpose. So there's a number of policies. Do you think that a general industrial zone could be seen to be consistent with those Chapter 4 policies for urban development?
Yes.
And so can you expand on that and say explain how?
So the policies seek direct urban development to occur within urban growth boundaries or within or adjacent to...
Well, it says within. It says...
The consent order is changing.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
In the reading the consolidated one.
This is the consent order one, which has added the words and adjacent.
And adjacent. Which I suppose leads to the development. I mean, the question is, are these... I mean, how do they relate to the Luggett Township? Are they truly adjacent to? I mean, they're not directly adjoining. They're not defined by a growth boundary. They're not... How do you reconcile these policies?
Yeah, I think... They're not... The site isn't directly adjoining the settlement zone. But the Symmetra's experience is that problems occur when you're trying to undertake these activities within or, I would suggest, immediately adjacent a settlement zone. The site's been described as on the urban fringe of Luggett. My interpretation of that is that it could be seen to be adjacent the settlement.
Is it sprawling or is it not?
Yes, you could look at it as sprawling or continuing urban development along Church Road or the consolidation of existing industrial activities along Church Road. So I think, in my view, the key point around the policies relating to urban development and settlements is whether they seek to limit urban development to the settlement zone, which I don't believe they do, or whether it's envisaged that a settlement could include a variety of urban zones, whether that be settlement and general industrial or something else.
And that, isn't that what the policies are referring to when they're talking about within urban growth boundaries or within settlements that, that include those range of activities?
Yeah, well, my interpretation of the policies is that it relates to they don't seek to limit urban development to the settlement zone. I think there's scope within there to provide for other urban zones as part of a settlement. I think
it sort of implies they're within the settlement though, not somewhere else, either within or at least directly adjacent to.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And just going to, and sorry, I'll try and wrap up. Just going to that question we had earlier on, is that if we're minded that this is only appropriate if we're able to release the industrial type activities from the Luggett Upper Clutha site in town, can you think of any mechanism with it which would allow that to give us comfort that that will occur prior, well, at least at the same time, if not ahead of?
Yeah, I can't think of any mechanism that would provide that certainty. I think what's proposed puts everything in place for that to happen, but it still relies on things falling into place to.
If, as I said, if we're minded that really the two are connected and that one is only acceptable or dependent on the other, is there anything you can suggest?
No, I'd
appreciate it. Asked a similar question. Okay. So that, that's all for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Christensen.
Thank you.
And we'll wish you well with your team's ongoing discussions with the council team. Look out for a minute, alerting you to Mr. Nolan QC's. Submissions.
Look forward to that. Thank you.
That you may wish to respond to.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. So, Kat, we have the representatives of the Ministry of Education zooming.
Good afternoon.
That is Mr. Frentz.
That is Mr. Frentz. My name is Keith Frentz. I'm a technical director in planning with Becca, and I'd like to thank you, the panel, for allowing me to present this evidence virtually, and I trust all the connections are as they should be.
We can hear you loud and clear, Mr. Frentz.
Thank you. I first of all would confirm that I've prepared a brief of evidence and in support of the submissions made by the Ministry of Education in relation to the plan, proposed plan. I can confirm my qualifications and experience stated in my evidence along with as directed in your minute 15, sir, my evidence covers all four of the zones that the Ministry has submitted on, the general industrial zone, the three parks commercial zone, settlement, and rural visitor zones. So you won't need to come back to me on these matters. Firstly, I have a short summary statement of my evidence, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions that the panel may have following that. Firstly, the Ministry is the primary provider of education services in New Zealand, but it's not the only provider. Schools take up large areas of land and the only spaces that are used by education facilities, and really that's why I'm here. Learning happens throughout all of life stages, and education is a fun.
Mr. Friends, you're fading out here. Can we just hold that thought?
I mean, every.
Back online.
I can see you.
We can hear you
but
now.
But you are shown as being on mute. Is that helpful?
We're good. You can go now. Thanks.
We're good now. Thank you. not sure if you heard that last paragraph, but I'd just say again, of workers and employers in industrial zones benefit from trade training establishments and childcare centres, and they don't need a rugby field, but they do need the right type of industrial environment. A note from the some of the Section 42A reports that there is a demand for education facilities throughout the district. I refer to the rural visitors zone, where paragraph 10.1. The report refers to a submission regarding the Camp Hill Road site, which includes a proposed future activity as being for education use. A submission is recommended to be rejected, but the proposal is then somewhat at odds with the report, which at paragraph 16.6 states that, in the reporting officer's opinion, the RVZ is not suitable for education facilities, the reason being that the purpose of the RVZ is to provide for visitor industry activities in generally remote locations at a limited scale and intensity. So in my view, this purpose does not preclude the provision of an education activity, and by enabling education as an activity in these locations, it adds to the sustainability of these remote locations. The Ministry's submission in each of these four zones requests that education facilities are enabled through an appropriate objective and policy framework and a restricted discretionary activity status. Whether your decision is to accept these submissions or look to provide for education facilities as full discretionary activities in the alternative, as is already provided in some of the zones, there should still, in my opinion, be a clear policy framework so that the processing planner is able to assess any future application in accordance with the guidelines provided. You already have education activities defined in Chapter 2, but there's nothing to support these activities in these zones. And I feel that a proper policy framework would simply make it easier for people in the future, like the processing planner, like the applicants, when they're faced with making an application or considering an application. That's all I really have to add to it. I'm available for any questions.
Mr. Friends, just looking at your suggested policy, enable education facilities to establish throughout the general industrial zone. Throughout means to me at any location. Is that really what you're suggesting?
I do note that in the airport air control boundary, the outer boundary of that, those sorts of activities or sensitive activities, noise-sensitive activities, are prohibited. And I'd probably agree with that. That's I wouldn't want to be there. I wouldn't want my anybody that I knew trying to learn in that environment. So that's probably an exception, but otherwise I would say that their education can take place in any area, really, any place.
Commissioner Hill.
Thank you. Mr. Friends, just a couple. Just following on from the Chair, the word enable suggests to me either permitted activity, you're suggesting restricted discretionary activity. Is enable the right policy approach? Is it providing for? Is that more what you're asking for?
I don't mind what language is used, really, Commissioner. I was trying to follow the structure and framework that was provided in the plan. So if that framework suggests that to be provided for or to provide for a restricted discretionary activity is better, then I'd be happy with that.
Okay, so it's not a major issue. Reading the council's rebuttal evidence, which doesn't support your position, and I wonder, is it the way that you're framing education facilities or activities, which could be a school, could be an early education centre, but could be a trade training or part of an existing industrial or commercial or service activity, is it an issue that the term is quite broad?
I think I appreciate the decisions to be made on definitions, but I go back to the definition in the National Planning Standard and trying to fit it around that. I don't think there's an issue with the fact that it is a broad definition. I think that this is taken care of through the matters of discretion and in the circumstances of the activity. What I probably had concerns about in the rebuttal evidence, the report from Council Planner, was there seemed to be an assumption that they were all schools with rugby playing fields and things like that. And I suppose the main thrust of my evidence is that they're not. They can be any size, any scale.
So you don't accept the what Mr. Place has said, that a lot of, if I'm interpreting correctly, what you're suggesting, not the school, but sort of the trade training or something, is part of an industry and therefore would already fit within the definition of an industrial activity or a service activity. Do you accept that or not accept that?
I don't think so, because you've got definitions for education activities in the plan, and you know, my feeling is that there shouldn't be two potentially conflicting definitions for the same activity. I'd rather have it clearly defined as an educational facility or activity.
Right. Thank you. My final question just goes to what you want about rural visitor zone, which you, as you read out, was how it was notified. What do you see as the relevance of an education facility within a zone which is designed essentially for visitors to experience the outdoors? Is it some sort of outdoor training proposal?
Yes, outdoor training, even a form of, I guess, awareness of a rural environment, so that I have to say I'm not familiar with what these zones do provide, but I could envisage that there could be perhaps outward bound type of education, environmental education, where you have an education process of you're getting people involved and engaged with the rural community there.
Thank you,
Mr. McLeod.
Just one from me. Just given the changing nature of education, and you are in fact educating us from afar, are we still, I'm
trying to get clear in my head the juxtaposition of a general industrial zone and education facilities within that. And that is a broad definition. So as by your defining, you put childcare in there. And I just find that quite a juxtaposition. I'd like you to expand on that for me if you could.
Yeah. I guess that there's a few examples I could call on that. In an industrial zone in Hamilton that we've dealt with, there's been a charter school established in, a warehouse, which was of about 3,000 or 4,000 square metres. And that suited the students and teachers for that school. In Tauranga, obviously I'm most familiar with these areas. In Tauranga, there's in a local industrial area, there is a forklift driver training school, and my son, in fact, has done that training. Quite a demand and need, I think, for childcare facilities. And obviously, these are sound insulated and suitable to that environment. But it is of benefit to the employers as well as the employees that people have the ability to have their children close to them in that time while they're working.
Thank you. That's all from me.
Commissioner Henry. Yep, just particularly with early childhood education in mind, but not necessarily limited to that. To what extent are outdoor areas an essential part of at least some education activities?
Depends on the activity. You had childcare centres in mind. I understand there is a requirement to provide for outdoor space at childcare centres. Again, it's how you manage that environment, and you probably don't choose one that is not going to be able to provide the services that you want if you're a private childcare provider, for instance. I think, too, that you say education facilities are changing, or the how you frame education in the modern day, and I think industrial activities also have changed over the last few years, so that there are much greater controls on the discharges of noise and odour and nasties into the air than there have been in the past. So I wouldn't personally be too concerned about how that relationship is framed, provided the controls are in place for that relationship.
How would reverse sensitivity effects be managed in an industrial zone if an education activity such as an ECE requiring outdoor spaces was granted? You either don't provide children with a safe acoustic or otherwise outdoor environment, or you accept constraints necessarily on neighbouring sites, don't you?
I think this is why it's a restricted discretionary activity in our suggestion. And that is a very valid element of that assessment. And it will depend on the site, it will depend on the activities around it, and it will depend on the needs and demands for it. If you look at childcare in the wider sense, it may not be an ECE as you're thinking of. It may actually just be a childcare facility, and that may be entirely within a larger factory or something like that.
Yeah, look, thank you, Mr. Friend. So my last question was, and you've half answered it, but I just want to draw it out explicitly, that the provisions you're putting forward could result in a de facto refusal of consent every time an ECE was proposed in an industrial zone, but still left the door open to a number of other education activities that didn't have, for instance, the operational need for that outdoor space.
I think you're right there, yes. Mm. And okay. It's to provide a the alternatives for people in that area.
Thank you. That's all. Commissioner Dawson?
No, no questions.
Commissioner
thank
Smith?
You.
Thank you very much, Mr. Friends. We'll call it a day there.
Thank you. And I say again, I'd appreciate the opportunity to do this by Zoom. I think it's a way forward rather than me spending a day and a half in an aeroplane. Thank you.
Not a problem. We have Cadence.
I don't have a summary. I'm just really here to say that the application of the Three Parks Business Zone is recommended by Mr. Roberts in his rebuttal and appropriately addresses the concerns of Cadence.
Commissioner Hill.
I suppose that was confirmed that. So what's recommended is a Three Parks Business Zone and you're satisfied if that's the decision. Your client's happy?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. I don't have anything further. Thank you.
Mr. McLeod?
I'm happy that everyone's happy.
Commissioner Monroe?
No, thank you.
No, that's what I wanted to know.
Commissioner Dawson?
Thank you.
Commissioner Smith? Okay. Everyone's happy. So, short but sweet.
Thank you.
The forces of the telecommunication industry.
We'll try and make this as quick as possible.
We are grateful for your patience. I'm also aware that you have planes to catch this afternoon, so we won't break for lunch.
We'll go as long as it takes.
It may focus the commissioners' minds as well.
This is an open question. Can I ask why you don't trust your own network so you can appear virtually? You don't have to.
We knew that question was coming. Face to face.
Well, I was going to ask about the connection between your facilities and COVID-19.
Excellent. I can answer that. I think the Prime Minister did that aptly by just saying there isn't any.
Exactly.
But it is a fun topic, and we could spend the afternoon talking about it.
I think Dr. Bloomfield's deafening silence said it all.
Yes. Yeah. No. In the parliamentary, in the Prime Minister's chief science advisor has well and truly put that one to bed in the minds of scientists anyway in the industry. So we're sort of in your hands around what information you need out of us. Mr. Horn and myself and I think Mr. Bray have got summary documents that have been handed around.
I've got one, but it is just a summary of what I've said. So in thinking of timing, maybe I'll just be ready for questions.
And so we thought we might just quickly run through the salient points within summaries, not reading out all of that, and then just really have a conversation of questions to help you, probably talking to Mr. Holding around radio frequency technical stuff, because that's probably where a lot of this sits, basically. So I suppose from an industry point of view, we do feel confused in Queenstown Lakes, where the council pushes us to provide the best technical network going in New Zealand. Queenstown Lakes gets technology generally ahead or at the same time as our big centres, yet the district plan remains quite difficult. And I think these zonings, these hearings, stage three ones, continue to show the issues that we have with this. Within my evidence set out a lot of the changes to all the sites that we've got in Queenstown Lakes over the last short period. And that's just something to remember within when thinking about this. We're aware that, obviously, we're critical and essential infrastructure, and as you can tell, actually having hearings via Skype or Zoom or whatever are really critical things. There's some things for us that I prefer to do face-to-face so that you can have that conversation. But for those short submissions, it's perfect in a lot of things. All of us did hearings during lockdown via Zoom and so forth, which is fantastic. So that from an industry point of view, it's been a long time coming where people have got the choice to do hearings on that, and we would have done some of ours in stage one if it had been available. I think one of the things when we did a pre-hearing discussion with the planners, reporting planners on this, which is really the first time we started talking about the issues that we were having, one of the clear things that I've made in my evidence, our industry's evidence, is we've probably kicked ourselves for not appealing the pole heights in stage one in reality. It has caused us problems, and it's now been transferred into the current situation, so we do need to have this sorted out so that the team designing the network can actually design the network and not have it constrained unnecessary by height. And I set out some of the factors of which when we're designing a network, it isn't just if we have 20 metres, then the height of a pole is 20 metres. It's a whole lot of engineering things that go into it, accountants get involved and so forth. And for us going forward, as everyone's aware, 5G, you know, the link to COVID-19, is the current rollout of the latest technology. But within the life of these rules, we'll be into 6G. And so that's how fast our technical needs, and we don't know what that's going to look like at that stage. So getting the rules right for the next 10 to 15 years becomes really important for us. And I'll just leave it at that point, hand it over to Stephen to really just set out some of the technical things.
thank you very much for your time. First of all, I'm going to give a summary of my evidence, and that was to complement the existing submission. So first of all, my name is Stephen Holding. I'm the lead RF engineer or radio frequency engineer at Spark, with over 16 years of experience in the mobile network design, optimization, and performance management. My evidence covers the very basic fundamentals of RF planning and optimization to demonstrate the requirements for increased pole heights, including attached antennas, in the new zones added to the district plan as part of stage 3 and 3B process. Just some key points I'd just like to run over again. So in my evidence, I make a clear comparison between an elevated ground installation and a street level installation and the achievable mobile coverage based on mast height. Due to increased obstructions from local clutter, terrain and other environmental factors, the mast height for a street level installation is critical. Wireless communication systems, such as mobile networks, is also interference limited, meaning each mobile site interferes with one another, affecting overall performance. To control inter-site interference, each mobile site is carefully optimized. Put simply, this is achieved by controlling the antenna azimuths, which is a horizontal plane, and the electrical tilting of the antenna elements. This step is not optional and is a vital part of site commissioning and acceptance, and can only be achieved if the antenna can utilize its full range of electrical tilt without restriction. And when I say restriction, I mean local clutter, buildings that may obstruct. Another important factor in the site design process is to ensure that each mobile site complies with the NESTF and the New Zealand standard, which sets out limits for RF exposure for people exposed at work or for the general public. Depending on the site configuration, building rooftops, balconies, or other elevated outdoor areas that are considered accessible to the public introduce a challenge that can only be resolved by mast height, power reductions, which will in turn reduce the coverage, or an alternative site location or a relocation of an existing site. In response to Mr. Place's evidence in his S42A report recalling my statement that 13 metres would be an absolute minimum permitted pole height for general industrial zones and is sufficient, it's important that the remaining statement be known, which identifies performance compromises at this height. Expanding further, 13 metres or 3 metres above the building height is an absolute minimum for an installation for a minimal configuration with limited near and mid-sill obstructions, no RF exposure restrictions in public accessible areas. In addition, not only does 3 metres above building height remove the possibility of co-location by other operators, it also limits the future capability of the site and may require additional sites in the local area to meet future demand. I continue to support the joint submission by Spark and Vodafone to seek more appropriately sized masts in the general industrial, Tree Park and Cadrona settlement zones. Any questions?
Well,
yeah.
Wonder if we take the two, McCarrison and.
Well, can I ask the I'll ask the naive question. Picking up Mr. McCarrison's and going forward, are poles always going to be the technology that, or the structure that's needed? Is there ever going to be other technology where they're not needed? And is that imminent, or is that just...
You mean the use of poles as a solution? So we do use buildings as mounts for antennas as well, and poles, and a number of other things. In these areas, typically, the buildings are so low that mounting on buildings will be an obstruction in itself with neighbouring buildings.
So it's always going to be a structure which is up in the, which has got clear something around.
Correct.
That's all right. So that's always going to be the case.
Yeah, so within the foreseeable future, you'll know that... may have heard around satellites and using Elon Musk, you know, SpaceX and a range of others. And within New Zealand, we already have satellite services, which are a lot slower into our rural areas. And so that type of service will start and continue to develop as we get more and more satellites in the sky, subject to the clutter up there. But at the moment, yeah, it's envisaged within the next couple of generations of technology that we're going to continue to have on the ground service, and particularly where we get into autonomous vehicles and all of that, because you need the service to be really fast and near the service.
You're right. And one of the big differences of a mobile network, the limiting factor actually is the uplink, so it's the mobile talking back to the base station. So with the base station itself, we could, you know, you can pump out as much power as you possibly need, but if the mobile can't talk back, then that's your limiting factor, hence the need to be able to be above the clutter so it can hear the mobile just as much as the downlink.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
General question is, do you need the height above the permitted building height or the height above actual buildings?
I suppose there's two aspects of it. The planning component of it is me setting up a envelope of which for Steve to design a network, and it's as Steve's picture sort of highlights what a radio engineer is looking to do is to try and get as much signal clear of buildings. And so if the existing environment or the realistic future environment is quite tall, then we're wanting to be reasonably high above that, because this only operates where it has line of sight reasonably of the antennae. And so that's the key purpose of it. So if we are, as the bottom part of it, restricted to be amongst the buildings other than RF compliance issues, then it's basically the building or the trees, other objects, absorbing the signal and so stopping the efficient service, basically. So height gives us efficiency, but sometimes height is a problem.
I guess we're allowing for a development that we're not sure that every building will be at that peak permitted height, or whether there'll be fluctuations in the height. So we've got to assume at this stage that they're all going to be at that particular permitted height. And this is what we need to do. But whether we actually need to be at that height will be dependent on that development.
Yeah. Mr. McCarrison, I want to talk to you about the NES. I want to make sure I'm understanding how this works properly. Like, it seemed to me that if for instance, we were to apply for provide for a permitted height limit of 18 metres, the NES would allow you to push that to 23 as long as you could do it in stages.
So two parts to it. If we had a new pole set up under the district plan, so in one of the urban zones, which is how that would need to be established, technically, and whatever height that we got, let's say you got 18, we could technically come along and use the NES in the future to add another 3.5 metre envelope on top of that. I suppose where our argument has been, there's an element of trust about the elements that go into how we set up sites. So they're expensive for a start. So when we're putting up a pole, we are really wanting to put up a pole that's got a reasonable 30-year plus life. The antennas will need to be replaced, but adding height to them often means we'll have to replace the whole pole, and that's where the accountants, and then we also run into issues that if it's near residential, permitted doesn't necessarily mean the residents around there are going to accept it, and probably seen lots of media stories around that component to it. So it's so yes, technically you're right, we'd prefer to build it once though in reality, and that's been our issue here, that in the low areas as part of stage one we are forced to use the district plan and then add to it by the NES later on, and that's partly in our minds a little bit deceitful. So.
There's an issue, as I understand it, in your evidence that co-location demands, may demand additional height.
Yes.
Holding gives us a series of options as to how you can do that. Should we be assuming co-location or making a height limit conditional on co-location?
That's one of the, Mr. Chairman, one of the suggestions in the position of the telcos is in two of those zones. I've actually asked for a height for a single operator and a height for colo, so that on day one you couldn't build to the full height unless you build it as a colo with two networks on it. That wasn't done for the general industrial zone, mainly because you're already going to have an 8 metre clearance, so you've got horizontal co-location options as well at that point, whereas in the other zones that are closer to the building height limit, you'd have to go higher. Not wanting to be the RF engineer, sorry, Mr. Holden.
And I suppose within the general industrial zone, there was an assumption that we'd probably use head frame, so a much wider head frame, so that the antennas would all be at the same level.
Yeah, and that's right. And when we're in the industrial zones, the idea is to put more of the radio hardware on the tower. So a simple cluster type head frame would not really be suitable in that instance. So
the height, the extra height in the other zones, particularly Cadrona, provides for a narrow, tight fitting configuration, basically. So that's the difference.
And is that because it's perceived, this is trespassing into Mr. Bray's sphere, because slim and narrow is less obtrusive than short and fat.
That's been our experience in terms of reaction from members of the public living near it or actually observing it and so forth. So,
also the slimline towers are really a lower capacity solution, so they're ideal for somewhere like Cardrona, where you're not looking at a city environment, where you're trying to cover multiple kilometres. So it fits there, so it's a better solution.
Go to the end. Commissioner Smith, since I keep leaving you to the end, working from my right to left.
I'll resist the temptation to ask 5G questions.
I'll feel
free. Which conspiracy are we going
to? Hello, Mr. Brett. Hi. I've got some questions for you from Ms. Millsop's rebuttal. I mean, you were probably going to cover those anyway, but I'll ask them.
Sure.
She's got some criticism of the way you've analysed what's suitable, particularly in the industrial zones. She says you haven't taken into account the context. I think she says things like some zones are very small and are very close to more sensitive zones. Some of them immediately join outstanding landscapes, for example, or join residential zones. And she talks about edge effects, and that also they differ widely in what's actually there, that there might be a height limit, but actually, for example, the Ballantyne Road area, she says, has been developed predominantly to 6 to 7 metres height. And she looks for a more cautious approach, I think she says, which is maybe 2 to 3 metres above the maximum building height with the setbacks from residential zones. So how do you answer those concerns of hers?
I think it's important to I think her difference is she's looking at a very detailed level.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at a plan which is very holistic. You've just heard evidence that, you know, Spark are trying to go above the 3 metres, but that's still not working for them. So actually what she's suggesting isn't actually a practical outcome that is sought. But in areas where the buildings are a little bit lower and are likely to stay lower, you've also heard to say we're not going to go and build an expensive tower that goes miles above that because, you know, there's no point to. So there's a practical reality associated with that. But I think probably the most key point that I have is that this is infrastructure that is required. It has to be built in order for, you know, our communities to operate as the way they are at the moment. And given that, we then have a holistic decision as where do we put it? Where's the best place, and where do we make it easier to put it, and where do we make it harder to put it? And my fundamental argument is that industrial areas, by their nature, are not going to be in the most pristine areas of the landscape. And I make it very clear that this region is beautiful. I mean, I've spent the last 3 or 4 days here on holiday, and it's glorious. There's no doubt about that. But you go to the industrial areas, and I have now visited them all since then. I've been previously, but I've now been again. And you drive through Wanaka, and you come down the hill from the Crown Range Road, and you see Wanaka there in front of you. It's lovely. And then you go to the Three Peaks area, which is right around the back. Three parks around the back there. You can't really see any mountains. You can't see the lake. I think I described it in my evidence, you know, out there, unremarkable. Because I think in the context of this region, it is. And the same with that place in Arrowtown. It is a small industrial area, but it's in a pretty average area of Arrowtown. In the context of what Arrowtown is, I mean, Arrowtown is a beautiful place, but that's the worst part of it. So if we're going to be
just remind you, you're being recorded here.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool. Yeah. As I say,
you still have to make the plane.
That's true. No, I mean, I think that, you know, we are in a beautiful place, but the industrial areas are in the least amenity areas of this place, and they're always going to be. And I think that's going on to the planning evidence, which says yes, but they have an amenity, and there'll be future ones that potentially will be on the side of outstanding landscapes. Why question that? Is that really the way that we are planning, that we are going to put, you know, big factories, you know, industrial activities on the side of our mountains that we can be seen at? Because if you are, then I think there's a whole lot more things to consider than just a telecommunications mast.
the council's lawyer observed to us that only in Queenstown Lakes would you put an industrial area at Coneburn at the foot of the Remarkables, because that's the only place you can find to put it, which is, in a way, a microcosm of the argument that you're putting, that this region, because of its dynamics, or this district, because of its dynamics, throws up atypical scenarios where, as I say, you have a future industrial area at Coneburn in possibly one of the most stunning locations in the country. And in the words of the esteemed leader of the US of A, it is what it is.
Yes. Yeah. And will Mitre still paint its building orange? Well, yeah, it did in Queenstown. Packet Save is still yellow. You can't, as you've heard, you can't bury this infrastructure. It has to be there. So when you're thinking about future industrial zone and where it might go, and then these rules are in place that says, well, it will include masts that are taller because it's better to put taller masts in industrial areas, in my opinion, then that becomes part of your thinking about when you're thinking about future industrial zones.
Thank you.
Mr. Bray, this is the border between you and Mr. Horn's sphere. Do we need specific standards to cover cross-zone effects? Like, this is related to the point that Commissioner Dawson was putting to you, that Ms. Malsot had made, that so you have the Glenda Drive industrial area adjacent to an ONF in the Shotover River. So how do we manage that?
Yeah, I'll let Mr. Horn answer most of that. I think the key thing for me is height in relation to boundary rules will work very effectively because they immediately create a diagonal height boundary.
I think Mr. Horn's only been suggesting height in relation to residential zone boundary.
Yes, that's correct. So that deals with the sort of immediate amenity and dominance effects of a immediately adjoining residential. If you think about the ONFs, ONLs, I mean, the reality with Queenstown is they're everywhere. So it's very difficult to not have, in an urban context, something that on a particular angle you may be able to see an ONL or an ONF in the distance through it. It's actually would be quite hard to avoid that. They're very big landscapes, and so that would be sort of a transitory view, I would imagine. It's not unique to Queenstown. Like, I've recently been involved in a project in Marlborough where there's an industrial zone smack bang beside an ONL, and it's 25 metre permitted height limit for infrastructure in that zone. So it's by no means unique, but it is... I guess the issue with this infrastructure is it is what it is. To do its job and be higher than buildings, you are going to see them, and so it's a matter of picking the best places for them and putting, I guess, the higher infrastructure in the more appropriate zones and the lower infrastructure in the more sensitive zones. Because the alternative to that is you actually have to put them in the ONLs to get the elevation, which, you know, I would imagine is you'd sooner have a transitory view through one than have it actually in the landscape you're looking at.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's the particular case in Cadrona. We either put it in the settlement or we have it up on the hill facing the settlement where it's highly visible to everyone in the settlement and passing through it.
Yeah. And to be fair, we already have quite a bit of infrastructure at that low level to get elevation in ONLs because 8 metres is a permitted height. And given that 97% of this district is an ONL, it seems appropriate to actually put the infrastructure where it should be and where we would normally expect, remembering that the zones that we're talking about aren't any more normal than what I see in the new ones in Highbrook and Auckland or Tauranga or anywhere else, of which we get 20 to 25 metres permitted to build within those zones, so that the infrastructure is next to the users, so that the Zoom calls work really well and you don't have the freezing and that sort of thing. And that's the critical thing. We need infrastructure near where the people are, and where people are in the wide open areas, they're probably less likely to want to use the phone in the same way that we use them for business and entertainment and so forth.
Can I pose a question, like you've given the example of the consent process in Hawea,
yes,
which proved to be somewhat interesting.
Yep.
Was that, what sort of issues were the local people raising? Was this the 5G conspiracy theory, or urban ambiance, urban amenity?
Yeah, well, got some of it. Each of us have probably got different perspectives. I mean, Shannon can talk about the landscape aspect of it, but right from when we started talking to them, really it was a lot of not in my backyard, but can I have the service, please? And so we were getting lots of complaints about our degraded service in that area, and from a network point of view, because the existing site was out in the rural area, we've since had to move that, and so hence that led to us withdrawing the resource consent, because the site that we got consent for technically just didn't work anymore. So it's pointless spending money on a site that's not going to work with the network. So consequence, we need another site because we've got other issues that have recently been in the media. But it was one of the fact that we've got a number of properties that we're looking through to the vista, even though they are 300 or 400 metres away, and the light pole that we were replacing just wasn't quite high enough to provide the reasonable network coverage that we needed at that stage. And we got a good decision. We were happy to defend that, but not going to spend money just for the sake of a principled outcome. So that's from my point of view, Shannon, presented evidence.
Probably the only thing I would add is that the key appellant to the court in that case was a person who had extensive views outwards towards the lake, the mountains, and I assess that as their primary view. They had a view back to the mast through their back bedroom and was most concerned about, you know, a back view where it wasn't in front of any outstanding landscape, but it was just the fact that they were going to see it from their back window. And that's unfortunate reality about all infrastructure, that some people like see it and take offence to it, some people don't mind it.
Commissioner Hill.
Just one final question. Mr. McCarrison, or Ms. Glenn, yours, you got, you know, under your heading nationally, and you go to every single district plan review.
Yep.
And you've given us some comparisons. How often are you having to seek submissions like this versus the plan provisions are already appropriate and this one is out of step, accepting the outstanding natural landscape issue here?
We, Chris and me, often end up at hearings, but at very finessed points of view because of the work that we've put in before the hearing, and so hence wanting a pre-hearing conversation, but actually conversations well before plans are notified. It's a pretty rare situation that we're to this point. In fact, this is pretty unique. Generally, we've already got to the 20 or 25 metres in the appropriate places, quite frankly.
I can't think of another plan, and there may be one, but I can't think of another one where there's height limits and an industrial zone this restrictive. So acknowledging the environments of Queenstown, but 20 to 25 is typical. And normally if you're having a debate at a hearing, it's not about the industrial zone. It's usually maybe one of the more suburban business zones, for example. So I know with the Dunedin plan, it started off as restricted discretionary off the cuff, regardless of scale, and I think we might have ended up at, I wouldn't want to give you the wrong number, but it might have been 15 metres in height to boundary for the small local shopping areas as a permitted activity after they. So that was the conversation we had there, but it wasn't really about the industrial zone.
Yeah.
The other thing is quite a few, particularly suburban residential areas, the typical solution nowadays is a light pole under the NES, and there's been a lot of those done, particularly in the lead up to the Rugby World Cup. There was a big rollout, and a lot of those are like 15 metres in residential zones, which is higher than what's being suggested in the general industrial zone, which just seems out of whack to me, because, you know, 15 in suburban residential nowadays is quite common.
Thank you.
Commissioner McLeod?
I'm still reeling from the chair referring to the leader of the USA as esteemed. I'm actually quite comforted that none of you had turned up with horns and bifurcated tails, which is... But no, I have no questions.
Mr. Monroe.
The principle that taller masts equals fewer masts. Is anyone able to give me an educated guesstimate of how many fewer masts the height limit sought might result in across these industrial zones compared to the council's proposed height limits?
As an example for Wanaka, we have a site on the hill called Hill End, and obviously you can see the whole of Wanaka. It's exhausted. It's completely, from a capacity perspective, it can take no more. So when we go and put it, when we start to drop sites down the bottom, it was part of a densification project. Ideally, what we want is at a height at the street level elevation that can see a wider area, so it can actually deload the site on the hill. If that site, for some reason, is not able to get above the clutter, its footprint will be considerably, it'll be quite small. We're talking about 500, 600 metres at maximum. And that's just luck, depending on the building structure and the material it's made out of. So then another site would need to be there. So if you're trying to cover, you know, an X square kilometre of an area, then you'd have to deploy sites according to the area. Typically we would like an industrial site of 8 to 20 metres to cover a substantial area. We're talking 5 to 6 kilometres radius, ideally. And again, if you don't get that height, then all of a sudden you'd be looking at an extra two, maybe three sites to cover the same area.
And the lower it gets, the less able we'll be able to share with one of the other operators. And so that's been one of the big changes over the last few years, and it's driven by economics. So our accountants stepping in, really pushing why not jointly build a site, particularly with Vodafone and so forth. And so it's... We were building new sites. That's one of the first questions that we have, unless there's some confidential reason we wouldn't. So if we end up having to build two extra sites, then they're going to want to do the same, basically. So you could end up with four or five extra sites.
So to help me as a layperson with no understanding of the cost and complexity of one shared mast versus five potentially separate little sites attached to buildings or whatever.
Yeah.
How could I, when reaching a decision on the differing points of view, how could I describe that scenario? Would it be a slight imposition on the operators given the scale of their what they do? Is it modest? Would it be substantial? How can I without appreciate you can't give us a mapped out hypothetical showing every square meter with coverage, but how can I take the principle that taller mass equals less mass and turn it into something a bit meatier for me to evaluate?
Could I pull the cost out of that for a minute, the financial cost? You'd have five sets of neighbours versus one set of neighbours, and it could be five sets of neighbours in rural and residential, rural residential environments versus one set of neighbours in an industrial context. So I suppose that in itself may affect less people more directly, but there's obviously a build cost which I can't get.
There's also a network performance impact which I've mentioned.
Yep.
That sites interfere with each other.
Yep.
Our ideal situation is to build one site.
So complexity, cost, hassle, maintenance, all of those things, I'm trying to understand the burden that you might be exposed to as a result of us favouring the council's recommendations. And at the moment, and it's not a criticism, I feel like I'm clutching at straws to understand, other than the principle, that it's not as efficient as you'd like, whether there's actual harm.
Yep.
So I'm hoping one of you can help put some substance to, is the council's suggestions seriously problematic or limiting, or is it just a buzzing fly that's a nuisance but not really in your way?
It comes back to the proposition of if you want to see more sites, then the council's pushing us into more sites.
Yep.
And the consequence of that, and so if we, this week, our industry body put out a warning to New Zealand local government and central government around the risk because of the economic crisis that for us to build efficient network that everybody wants at a cheap price, and New Zealand's got very cheap data plans at the moment, some of the cheapest in the world, then the industry has to find another way to fund it. And the more times we're put into a regulatory environment that's pushing us to build inefficient network, then that drives it. Each site's going to have a similar cost. So a lower site, yeah, proportionately is a bit cheaper. Higher site's just going to be more efficient from a, I don't know, in terms of dollar percentage, I haven't thought about that, but because everyone's, each site's quite bespoke, but if you take 150,000 for a new site, 120,000
minimum
site, up to 200, 250, transmission galley might be $1 million a site, then each one of those is a significant cost. And if we have to spend, put five sites into Queenstown, like four additional sites, then that means four additional sites aren't being built somewhere else on our network. And so as a consequence, we might actually choose, we'll just put one site in Queenstown to make sure Tauranga, Hamilton and Dunedin get a fair share of the custom service, because we can actually provide better service to more customers in those places. And that's what we're having to evaluate kind of each time. So it's kind of quite hard, because at the end of the day, we just want to have as many people able to connect as fast as possible.
Understood. That's great. We're all hungry. I just want to box through this one.
Yep.
So, Mr. Bray.
Just while we're on that, sorry to interrupt, but as a person that lives in Wanaka, it's Queenstown Lakes.
Yep.
Queenstown refers to the place across the hill, that and we are one district.
Yep.
So it applies to the dual district. Thank you.
And you can guess which half the commissioner's from.
Yeah. So, Mr. Bray, I'm not sure, as I read the council's evidence, I'm not sure they've necessarily appreciated that it's not just comparing the same number of poles but at a lower height, but that if there's more poles at a lower height, there's perhaps less effect per pole but maybe more effect in the aggregate from more poles. Are there any comments on that you want to add to what you've already said in evidence in terms of how we evaluate the council's proposition versus your clients?
No, I don't think so. I think it's pretty much covered in my evidence in chief, but I have addressed that. I mean, I do take the position that, yeah, less is generally better. Even a smaller pole, say in a residential environment, you know, say it's 12 or 15 metres high, it's still going to be, it is still there. It's, I was going to say it's still noticeable. Actually, it's remarkably unnoticeable. It's remarkable how many people don't see them. I've been here with my partner for the last few days, and she still hasn't noticed that there's two poles outside the door here. And she knows we're here for this purpose. So it is remarkable how people don't see them. But the more you have them, the more chance there is that people will see them, the more cumulative that effect is. So in my view, less is better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That's all.
Commissioner Dawson?
No, I'm finished, thank you.
Commissioner Smith?
No.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming to you.
Good questions, thank you.
We will adjourn and be back at 2:00.